From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View, your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. This week's view discusses a number of recent studies on heart disease in athletes. We're entering into the season when many individuals are prepping for fall sports. Hopefully during some of our summer vacations, we're all out exercising and trying to attain essential heart health. And it seems like a good time to review some interesting articles that have come up as they relate to athletics and exercise and cardiovascular risk. Today, I'm going to talk about four articles, all of which can be found on acc.org that I think will be of interest to cardiovascular caregivers and to individuals, whether they're older, masters athletes, simply deal with people who are thinking about exercise, and also those who are involved in diagnosing younger athletes who are considering sports participation. So our first article addresses the lifelong effect of exercise on coronary artery disease. The title is The Relationship Between Lifelong Exercise Volume and Coronary Atherosclerosis in Athletes. The paper was published in Circulation. And it really asks the question of what is the relationship between the volume of exercise and the presence of coronary artery calcium and, importantly, plaque characteristic. This study looked at middle-aged men who were engaged in competitive or recreational leisure sports, and they underwent a non-contrast and a contrast-enhanced CT scan to look for coronary artery calcification and plaque characteristics. The participants reported their lifelong exercise history patterns, and their exercise volumes were multiplied by the metabolic equivalence of the task scores to calculate an interesting metric, met minutes per week. And then they were divided into three groups, less than 1,000 met minutes per week, 1,000 to 2,000, or the more high-intensity group, greater than 2,000 met minute per week. The author studied 284 men, average age 55. A calcium deposit was present in at least 53%, 150, and the median calcium score was 35.8. It's interesting that athletes with a lifelong exercise volume greater than 2,000 met-minute per week, there were 75 of those, had a significantly higher calcium score than those in the lower categories. And the odds ratio for that was 9.4. They also had a higher prevalence of coronary calcification at all, and that odds ratio was 3.2. And also plaque, an odds ratio of 3.3. The very vigorous intensity group, those who exercised to a level greater than 9 mets, that was also associated with a higher calcium score, odds ratio 1.47, and plaque presence 1.56. It was interesting, among participants with plaque, the most active group, those athletes or individuals who were in the greater than 2,000 met-minute per week, they actually had a lower prevalence of mixed plaques, 48% versus 69%, and more often had just calcified plaques compared to the least active group. So in conclusion, this is a very interesting article, a fairly large number of individuals, well-characterized. There was a higher calcium score in the higher-intensity lifelong athletes, but they appeared to have a more benign composition to their plaque, with fewer mixed plaques and more often calcified plaques. So certainly, this is a fascinating look at not only the presence of calcium, but also the type of plaques that these individuals had. The second article is also useful in terms of this particular topic. It's entitled Prevalence of Subclinical Coronary Artery Disease in Masters Endurance Athletes with Low Atherosclerotic Risk Profile. This was also published in Circulation recently. And it asks the question, what is the prevalence of coronary artery disease in masters endurance athletes who have a low atherosclerotic risk profile by traditional measures? They looked at 152 masters athletes mean age 54 years, 70% were male. And they were compared to 92 patients who were at control of similar age, sex, and low Framingham 10-year risk scores. These people underwent an echocardiogram, exercise stress test, CT angiogram, and a coronary calcium assessment. They also had an MRI of their heart to look for late gadolinium enhancement and 24-hour holters. On average, the athletes in this study, 152 of them, had been involved in endurance exercise for a mean of 31 years. Most of them were runners, in fact, about 80%, and they had completed a median of 13 marathons per athlete. So these are lifelong athletes and mostly are runners and marathon runners. It was interesting in terms of results. Most of the people had a normal calcium score, 60% of the athletes and 63% of the controls. But compared to sedentary men, male athletes had a higher prevalence of atherosclerotic plaque of any severity, 44 versus 22%. And only male athletes had a calcium score greater than 300, 11%, or luminal stenosis greater than 50%, and that was seen in 7.5%. Again, interesting, like the last study I just talked about, male athletes had predominantly calcific plaques, whereas sedentary males more often had mixed plaques. And the athletes that had luminal stenosis greater than 50% more often were those who had more years of training. So this article also showed that most lifelong masters endurance athletes have a low atherosclerotic risk profile, and most of them have a normal calcium score. But among those who do have an elevated score compared to sedentary men, the male athletes, the composition of the plaque was predominantly calcific, not mixed. And we know that these mixed plaques are thought to be more likely to cause coronary plaque rupture and events that we really care about, like myocardial infarction and sudden death. So taken together, the two articles sort of show that although higher levels of coronary calcium might be seen in these lifelong athletes, the type of plaque is potentially different, and we really don't know whether, on average, they're at higher risk because of the calcifications or potentially lower risk because the type of plaques they get are more benign. So we need more studies, but I thought these two papers on coronary plaque and particularly the type of plaque in longtime exercisers were interesting for our audience. So now I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about the athlete with catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia. This comes from our sports and exercise cardiology topic collection on acc.org. And it's a really nice piece written by Michelle Murphy and John Ferguson. So catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia, and I'm going to call it CPVT. It's uncommon, but it's a significant cause of sudden cardiac death in people with structurally normal hearts. Most typically presents with palpitations or syncope during physical or emotional stress, and it may be fatal. In the last decade or so, we've learned a lot about the underlying genetics of CPVT, and we've also learned more about risk stratification and also treatment. Thankfully, the incidence of this, of sudden cardiac death in young athletes, is really low, probably somewhere around 1 in 100,000 athletes. And most often, it's due to a cardiac structural problem, like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, coronary anomalies, etc. However, CPVT is one cause, and it accounts for about probably 12% of autopsy-negative sudden deaths and 1.5% of sudden death in infants. Its true prevalence is unknown, and there's certainly controversy about how we should both screen and treat this particular type of problem. Currently, athletes with catecholaminergic polymorphic ventricular tachycardia are advised against physical activity, and they are typically told that they should not participate in competitive sports of any kind. The genetics of this are interesting. It's a highly malignant inheritable cardiac channelopathy. The problem does not typically cause prolongation of the QT at rest. Most recently, missense mutations involving human cardiac ryanodine receptor 2 gene mapped chromosome number 1 may be associated with CPVT, and there seems to be an autosomal dominant pattern of inheritance. Sylvia Priori and others have shown that CPVT is clinically and genetically heterogeneous, however, and it can present both in pediatric age as well as older. The probands who identify genotype positive for this ryanodine receptor 2 mutation seem to present earlier, with males having a higher cardiac risk for cardiac events. So it was widely accepted for years that this is a disease of childhood, most people coming to light on or before age 21 with a median age of 15. The incidence of cardiac events is over 48 years, 12 and 32%. Other studies from as low as 2% to as high as 60%. Most recently, a bimodal distribution of symptom onset has been identified, with this juvenile type presenting in the first two decades of life, and an adult type of CPVT presenting at age 32 to 48 years, with a mean around 40 years, more of a female predominance, and usually ryanodine receptor 2 genotype negative. So these patients typically have a normal ECG. The delay between their presentation and diagnosis is often delayed because they have structurally normal heart and at rest an electrocardiographically normal heart. But in a young person who has a stress-related syncopal episode, palpitation, loss of consciousness, one would want to think about this for sure. The diagnosis for this often relies on the demonstration of the arrhythmia during non-invasive exercise testing, or some patients have an epinephrine drug challenge. A positive test is defined when there's complex ventricular ectopy or biventricular VT or polymorphic VT. Obviously, a negative stress test does not necessarily exclude CPVT, and patients who have recurrent symptoms should be studied presumably again. Genetic testing and family screening are typically going to be done when you find a proband who has the receptor abnormality. Then you would potentially screen additional family members, and those who have the receptor positive would be treated with beta blockers. The current treatment, beta blockers, are really the drug of choice for treatment and prevention of ventricular arrhythmias. Their efficacy is modest and can vary depending on whether the drug is cardioselective or not and the amount of drug used. Calcium channel blockers, sometimes in combination with beta blockers, also appear to reduce exercise-induced ventricular arrhythmias. And flecainide, you know, a class 1C antiarrhythmic drug that affects the sodium channel, has also been studied and shown to reduce ventricular arrhythmias and defibrillator-induced VT storm in patients who've been refractory to both beta blockers and calcium blockers. Right now, an ICD is considered a 2A recommendation for patients who have CPVT with syncope or other documented sustained ventricular arrhythmias on beta blockers. But be aware that ICD therapies could heighten the catechol response, resulting in inappropriate shocks or even electrical storm, and that's seen in as many as 1 out of 5 patients who gets a device. In the rare patient who's symptomatic despite high-dose beta blockers, who's intolerant or refractory to drug therapy or an electrical storm, left cardiac sympathetic denervation may be required. Thankfully, that is rare. So it's an interesting article about a fairly unusual disorder causing ventricular tachycardia in typically younger individuals, and I thought I would bring it to you in this week's podcast. Finally, as we get into the time of the year when we're thinking about screening athletes, there's a final article I wanted to discuss today, and it's called The Impact of the International Recommendations for Electrocardiographic Interpretation on Cardiovascular Screening in Young Adults. This was published by Dutia et al. In JACC. The study question is, how do the recently revised international interpretation recommendations for the ECG screening in young athletes affect the number and cost of additional cardiac tests? And as you know, there's a lot of debate about how much screening we should do in individuals being considered for competitive athletics. Some places indicating that we should do a routine ECG on everybody. Others saying we should do a careful history and physical and provide electrocardiographic assessment only in patients where there's a higher clinical suspicion for an abnormality. So this study looked at about 5,000 patients who were unscreened athletes in the United Kingdom between 2011 and 2014. Their age was 14 to 35, 26 different sports, and they were evaluated by cardiologists using a standardized health questionnaire, physical exam, and a 12-lead ECG. Interpreted both using the 2010 ESC recommendations and then the subsequent application of the international recommendations. And they calculated the cost of secondary studies based on the analysis of the ECG. So a total of about 5,000 athletes About 80 of them, or 1.6%, had an abnormal health questionnaire or physical exam. Application of the international recommendations resulted in 146, that's 3%, of the athletes being classified as having a positive ECG. Along with the history and physical exam, inclusion of the ECG interpreted in accordance with the international recommendations would have resulted in 3.8% of the cohort getting an echo, 1.2% a stress test, 1% a Holter, 0.9% a cardiac MRI, and 0.4% would be other tests. And it's interesting, if you compare the older 2010 ESC criteria to the newer international criteria, there is a substantial reduction that happens with the international recommendations. And they reduce the costs of screening to an average of $80 per athlete and about $26,000 per serious diagnosis. So this would be a major reduction in expenditure by using a more narrow definition for electrocardiographic interpretation and what represents normal versus abnormal. Overall in this group, only 15 athletes, that's 0.3%, were diagnosed with a serious cardiac disease, hypertrophic disease in 6, long QT in 3, and WPW in 6. So the authors of this study concluded that the newer international recommendations are associated with a significantly lower number of abnormal ECGs, and this leads to an impressive reduction in workload and cost of screening athletes without compromising the ability to detect the athletes who have serious problems. It's certainly clear then from this study that the number of athletes who will have an abnormal ECG is very small. And we want to be careful about not disqualifying athletes who are really not at risk. So I like the article a lot. Certainly there remains debate about whether we do an ECG or not and then how we interpret it. This study certainly suggests that the newer international recommendations for interpretation potentially make that type of screening more cost-effective than just using typical ESC 2010 definitions for an abnormal ECG. So that is a quick survey of four interesting pieces that you can find on acc.org that we've recently posted. For our listeners who have an interest in sports and medicine, all of this can be found in the clinical topic collection on sports and exercise cardiology. I want to thank you for listening to Eagle's Eye View. This is your weekly cardiovascular update from acc.org. Find us online or whenever you get your podcasts. And I look forward to talking to you again next week.